Thanks. Greg, you have a service.
Greg Schaefer, Public Works Development Engineering.
Nicole Snyder, Community Development.
Steve Baker, Park Regional Wastewater.
Bob Gaither, Gaither Homes.
Eric Lino, SJ Engineering.
Vicki Nonner, Community Development.
Mike Ogren, Olson Engineering.
Yeah, I'm Drumford, BLS Engineering.
Don Hardy, Port Jerabam. Steve?
Steve Madison, Public Works.
Brent Davis, Environmental Services, New BP Development.
Thank you. Meeting today is being recorded. Ask you guys to silence your cell phones if you've got them on. Review and adopt minutes. Has everybody had a chance to review minutes from last meeting?
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed and moved for adoption.
Second. Any discussion? Moving second and all in favor?
Aye.
Next item, upcoming events. Greg.
Upcoming events. We do have a few in June. It's a little less in number, but we do have a few. Our standard work sessions, if they are held typically every Wednesday, can begin as early as 9 a.m. You'll want to check the board schedule for that for any updates. Board of County Councilors hearings also every Tuesday, 10 a.m., except for the first Tuesday of the month. This typically goes to an evening meeting at 6 p.m. And then there is one hearing biannual code. That's on Tuesday, June 28th, 9 a.m. Under Planning Commission, there's a public hearing, the Comprehensive Growth Management Plan update, Thursday, June 2nd. Of course, that's actually today, so this evening at 6:30 p.m. And then of note, there are no Planning Commission work sessions or public hearings scheduled for the month of July.
Great. Any board member announcements?
I testified and delivered our memo at the comp plan hearing last week. And then also just a brief update on the intersection committee that's been kind of passed off to transportation. And kind of the plan is to kind of follow up with them and figure out what's the next steps in implementation of our recommendations. And I believe it's in transportation's hands at this point.
And Eric, just on that note, were you expecting that to be a discussion topic today?
No, I was just going to give an update.
Okay.
I want to keep it on the radar.
Okay.
Because we made action, the committee put a lot of work into it. And it's one of those things I want to make sure that it actually happens and comes to fruition, not just kind of keep moving forward.
Don, I actually have one, if it's okay to mention. Absolutely. Briefly here, and I think we touched base with all of the DEED members a week or so earlier. This is in regards to the county has an interest to add one member to the DEED board. So to go from, and you should have copies of this on draft on your bylaws. So this would be a modest amendment to our bylaws. You'd find this on page 204 under section 3 membership. And so, in effect there, we are changing from 9 to 10 members, as you see in the first paragraph, and then a little further in the document that would include one member associated with commercial or industrial development was the only change there. So I think the action we would be requesting, if Deeb is in agreement to that, is to move to amend the bylaws.
Second.
And I guess everybody's, I think, on board with this, and there was some discussion email-wise, so felt like there's consensus around that issue, so probably no need to have any discussion around it. I think we're all in favor.
I think the only thing that I got out of the emails was more important than maybe in the language to have someone that is more on the development side, you know, rather than on the contracting side I got that from several team members that someone that's actually working with the regulations that we're dealing with rather than the UBC or whatever.
And the item in here talks about it says one member who's associated with commercial or industrial development.
Right, that's right. Yeah. I think the language takes care of that. I just want to point that out.
I think. Okay. And I think we're consensus, so we have a motion.
Yep.
More continued discussion, please.
We'll hold it. Relative to the motion that's on the floor?
Yes.
Okay.
Relative to the motion that's on the floor, insofar as how the bylaws are being rewritten or proposed. In here we talk about
quorum, and it is a majority of the sitting board members, how would that then have to take place? Are we going to leave it at that?
Sure. Six instead of five.
Right.
And the question is about a tie, is that perhaps what you're...
And we could probably discuss that outside of this motion here. I just wanted to bring everybody's attention, you know, what Robert's Rules of Order talks about with regards to...
I have a suggestion on that after we vote on this.
Sure.
Okay. Got a motion?
I'm not going to say it's not, so...
Okay. And a second?
Yeah, somebody seconded
it. Yeah. I did, yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, we should note that Mr. Riston and Mr. Snell have joined us.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Sorry.
She's all for parliamentary procedure.
I'm sorry I wasn't early, which would be on time. Mike's mother, right?
What's that?
If I was early, I'd be on time.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you're on time. Remember that.
I was late today.
Oh, good.
Just for the record, you showed that I was late today.
We're human then. I will say on the tie, at least in my experience on the Planning Commission, we came out with a lot of ties, you know, abstentions, things like that.
Because you had seven members.
Yeah, we had a lot of ties in terms of, you know, members wouldn't show up, this and that. Commissioners get a tie. I mean, that's we're just advisory. So to me, it's they get a tie, so they realize.
I missed the conversation about adding somebody from, like, SWACA, is that?
Yeah. Development,
commercial industrial.
Yeah. So there's.
So I was talking to somebody about that recently last week. Who was I talking to?
Might have been in passing. I don't know.
Might have been somebody in this building. I don't know. I have too many conversations with too many people.
You see it?
Yeah, that's it. No, it was. It came to my. Somebody was asking me. I said, well, we have somebody from BIA, but not somebody from Contractors Association for commercial, industrial, non-residential, so.
Well, Eric's a member. Yeah, well, a few of us in here, I think, are members of both.
Well, I met with Darcy and their executive board a couple weeks ago and shared with them some things that were going on. All right. Let the record reflect that I was late in this conversation.
So noted.
Hey, it was in a better mood than last.
Nicole takes meticulous notes. It'll be there.
Moving on. See, Marty, you're right on the agenda, though.
Am I?
You are plot extension, site plan.
So I had a hard time locating a resolution that was adopted by the board. So I asked somebody, I think from the clerk's office, and I got something from, I think, maybe 2012 or something. So it's a while ago. We've extended the preliminary approvals of projects from a date back, and the end of that is the end of this year, December 31, 2016. So I know there have been a lot of discussion. Susan's fielded a lot of questions from callers and consultants. So, you know, I've got something in front of the board. I mentioned something to Councilors Bolt and Olson about that there's going to be interest in extending at least for one more year. So I don't know. I did say that, you know, that some folks from the DEEB may be contacting you. I don't know, James, if I talked to Mark or Julie or anybody else. There's only kind of one downside that I mentioned to the counselors, and that is, you know, when we have PUDs and subdivisions that were done in, you know, 2005, 6, 7, and they're small lot, some of the counselors don't like the ultra small lot, but that's, you know, and they don't like PUDs. And there's some discussion about, you know, why are these approved and why are these coming forward, and because they can and they're legal. And there's been an investment, you know,
made. That's about the only downside. So I'll catch up with Commissioner or Councilor Bolt and see when he wants to put it on the agenda. But it is done by resolution and not ordinance. An ordinance would have to come through the Planning Commission, and the ordinance would be permanent. We've done these by resolution that, that, you know, with a sunset date. So that's kind of where I'm thinking. I don't know if, Susan, you have anything to add, or certainly for a group discussion.
What is the order of magnitude? How many lots are we talking about?
How many projects?
Yeah, I mean...
Many.
We haven't put that list together. Okay. I mean, there's it would be hard to do. You could, it'd be hard to do. But I have gotten a lot of phone calls just talking to people and wanting to do, especially the situation where they need to get a post-decision done now so they can even have a chance of making FLD mostly, but also FSR and building permit before the end of the year.
So what would the cutoff date be now?
It's the end of the year.
First 2016.
December 31.
No, but if we extend it, it'll be
2017.
The recommendation is
for or not. I mean, by the time it gets done, then you're.
If they go one more year, it's December 31, 2017.
Right.
But they could look at an earlier cutoff. They could say, you know, September 1. I mean, it's really their discretion.
Okay.
Has Deep made a recommendation?
There's been some discussion, but not a full recommendation.
I don't believe we've actually made a formal recommendation on it.
I don't know if you made
a
request.
He has not
made a request. I think it's coming through. Yeah, mostly. Yeah.
And I can tell you, we've had a discussion. There's a lot of projects that are moving forward just because they have to. And one thing I'm concerned with is county staff has already bogged down. The development community in general, contractors are bogged down. And if they're moving forward just for the sake of it, it's going to actually overload county staff. It's going to overload the rest of the community and stuff that actually people want to move forward, not because they have to.
It's kind of an artificial urgency.
Yeah, it is. And some of them are challenging projects. A lot of them that are still left have to work through some things and rushing through things. And,
yes.
Right.
There are some challenging projects.
Yeah. So I found that resolution, though.
From Vancouver or from?
No, from
county.
County.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have it? Do you need it?
I have a copy from the 2000.
What's
it?
2013.
Yeah, that's the last one.
Okay, yeah, I have a copy of that if you need it. So, do we need to make a recommendation to pursue it?
Are you looking for one more?
I think it would be helpful to hear from what their position is and what their request would be. So it's not staff.
Well, I'll make a motion and then have a discussion. So I move that we make a recommendation for the county councilors to extend land use approvals similar to the 2015 resolution to the end of December 31st, 2017.
So does that include plat and site plan?
It includes whatever the resolution is.
Yeah, second that.
Discussion?
So the discussion would be, I think Eric raises some very valid points. It's really hot right now. I think that I know this person to the left of me, this person to the right of me, and Mr. Palivo and others are very good projects, and I know the county has as well. It seems rather than creating an artificial choke point, allowing it here to let some of this stuff come through, beneficial. I am wary, however, of just keep giving these guys a lifeline. So I don't know, I kind of want to make this one ahead.
Until next year. I saw some glint in your eye.
He's on the record.
I'm on the record.
I think Eric makes a good point that a lot of these are pretty challenging. We're up against the deadline. The county's struggling to get through stuff. Contractors are all. Absolutely right. We've got a
about creating this race right now with the current timeline and it's making it maybe unnecessarily difficult for everybody involved. So that's my thoughts.
And then to the extent of the housing supply issue, my feeling is that's another important element is providing that opportunity because it takes a long time to go through that process. I'm not sure if there's 500 lots or 1,000 lots or how many there are, but it's probably quite a few, is my guess.
Are a lot of them having to be reworked from a stormwater standpoint?
That's a big issue.
And there's a provision, though, that basically says if you have to redo stormwater, you're subject to the new rules.
Right.
Right.
And you have to redo stormwater
unless
you have construction plan approval, which most of these don't at this point, right? I mean, we're assuming these are the end of the end, probably. Or I'm just trying to figure out whether we're getting, because they're not only reworking the stormwater, but they may be reworking or
sometimes it's a chain reaction.
Lot configuration and buildability and things like that, which I think, the memo, in my opinion, is out in terms of trying to have better lots. You know, that these, a lot of these that are left over might be infill, triangular, pie-shaped, difficult to build, and maybe they just need a little more time to not only do stormwater, but also to reorganize or replat. I don't know. I don't have any of these, but I've seen some, and I would probably arrange them differently, engineer them differently.
There's a lot of reasons why they're just coming back now. One, the lot price and the economy has just came back to where these are economically viable again. And it seems like a long time, but they went down so far where the lot values are just finally coming back where no one is going to move forward to throw good money after that and move forward on some of these. They made a significant investment in them, but the lot price has gotten up so much that they're just finally to where they're viable. Another piece of it is when the stormwater injunction came down and they basically threw out stormwater vesting. These projects now are impacted by that. And most of them that are still left, the ones that have good infiltration, they probably already moved forward. They were able to absorb it. Now, again, they have to absorb that change in the stormwater. They might lose additional area or have to do additional things to make it more costly. So they're having to adjust it now. And again, it takes between the economy and that change has made it where these are just starting to make sense again.
I do have the 2013 resolution.
You do? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Looked at it a lot over the past few months.
Is there a motion and a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Moving on to the next item. Impact fees.
Jimmy? Yeah. So I apologize for not getting this out earlier.
What is that, Jimmy?
It's what you handed out before.
Oh, is it? Okay. Did I give you? Well, I have the whole bill here.
I did.
5923.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was just some language that I think we had worked on prior here. So, just to refresh everybody's recollection, Marty said it was 58, it was 1798. The house.
5923. Senate Bill.
5923 passed in 2015 after a couple runs at it, and it was signed into law by him. So it has an effective date of September 1st of this year. And again, what the requirements of the bill are is that if you have an impact fee program, you're required to adopt some sort of deferral up to the first 20 lots per builder per year per jurisdiction. You could do that via a variety of mechanisms that are spelled out in the statute. I do know that the City of Vancouver just announced their SEPA that they're moving forward on their proposed land right now and ended up commenting on it. The SEPA, at least this week, I haven't seen their draft language yet. But a lot of the jurisdictions that are moving forward with the language have just elected not to put the artificial limitation of 20 on there because they don't want to create a two-tier system, quite frankly. having to track multiple things, and realistically, there's not a ton of builders out there that are building more than 20 units a year. I think that policy reason was that why it came back in that form was the governor didn't want to reward large national builders. So there was this compromise to really try to make it help out the local folks. And so I think there's a good policy discussion that we had here as to whether or not have that limitation or not.
The additional work on going more than 20 in a year, though, requires the county to consult with the school districts?
Correct.
And we must give substantial weight to the recommendations of the school districts regarding the number of additional deferrals. I have the whole bill here. I can make copies of it if anybody wants it. But that's one piece that I'll need to work on. And the other challenging piece for me is the September 1st a deadline, which I actually looked at whether or not, you know, what is the harm of going past September 1? I'm implementing a new system, and I don't want to build a deferral system in Tidemark for residential when that's going away by the fall.
Makes sense.
Does it?
No, I mean, I don't think so.
Well, some people. I'm glad you see it my way. We're on the same page. No, it's
teacher's bad.
So, you know, we have work to do either way, and I'd rather just do it once. So.
And I've thought about that too, Marty. And I.
Was it a good idea?
Oh, okay. Anybody else want to jump on the group think?
So what does substantial weight mean?
It's more than insubstantial weight.
Of course, you're going to raise your hand and say, no, I want my money now. Why would I wait?
Well, the bigger school districts, I don't know whether or not, you know, Vancouver and Evergreen would care one way or the other. Maybe some of the smaller districts where larger developments may affect their CFP more immediately, like Hawkinson School District or maybe Camas Washougal, some of the smaller districts.
Now, I understand someone raised their hand, but what weight are you going to subscribe in your decision-making process?
Well, they're going to want their money, and they want their money sooner than later. But we were looking at deferring. That's
the point of it.
Right.
Deferral.
So I think, you know, if I'm thinking that both the school districts and the money people, the treasurer's office, who has to hold these monies in accounts that then are dispersed to the junior taxing districts, they just want surety. And the surety in the bill, there's one form of surety, which is a lien. And it's then there's the administrative hassle of recording a lien, mm-hmm. and then releasing the lien, and and removing the recordation of the. So it's kind of a hassle. One idea that I don't know if other jurisdictions have kicked it around, but for residential is we won't do a final inspection until you pay your impact fees. And a final inspection or a CFO, you make your impact fee payments, we'll get you the final inspection or a CFO. The only trouble with that is that, you know, I wouldn't want somebody to move a family in over a weekend before a final and then like, oh, you need to get kicked out until the builder pays the impact fees.
Mm-hmm. There's some policy calls in there, but Marty brought that up. The way that the IBC model code works is if you request to get a final inspection, the jurisdiction has no leniency in issuing the CFO, so you get it.
Right.
It's a shall issue. best assurance to get it, my money is really at the sale of lot.
Yeah.
Because then it's not,
what?
Sale of lot.
Yeah, like a closing cost.
Closing cost.
And that's where I need to work with the financial people on the second floor. Treasurer, auditor, assessor.
Well, the sale lot at what point, though?
Okay, I'm going to keep the original rental pool and
the original
rent it for 5 years. That has to be a different
Or it's an apartment complex.
Yeah, that's different. Well, apartment complexes get different. I mean, that's a different animal than single-family res, which is going to just get, you know, there's a transfer. Jeff's going to build a home and somebody's going to buy it.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. So a developer sells to a home builder. So there's a point of sale.
Well, but not on the home.
Not on the home.
Yeah. I've got to go to a 3 o'clock.
And there's a sentence here that says the person signing will impact the assessment is ultimately responsible for insurance.
It's usually the builder.
Is that a personal guarantee? Is that meant to be a personal guarantee? Or is that meant to be, like, if I sign on behalf of an LLC?
So here's the language in the bill, kind of, you know, the deferred impact fee lien, which must include legal description, so on and so forth, must also be in a form approved by the county, city, or town, signed by all owners of the property with all signatures acknowledged as required for a deed, and recorded in the county where the property is located, binding on all successors and title after the recordation, and junior and subordinate to one mortgage for the purpose of constructive construction upon the same real estate property granted by the person who applied for the deferral of impact fees. So it's pretty exhaustive. And anything that we would do, we would have to run by our legal folks. So I've got to get with the school district. I did run into John Dieter with Evergreen School District last week, and I was hoping to catch up with the school district sooner than later. So
they, because of the state rule, they have to accept the deferral of the first one.
Correct. Yep.
So this other memo we looked at here was passed around. This is old, right? Because it talks about the city of Vancouver not even being included. The school district. This is old, right? The one that just kind of went around.
No, what I sent here, section C is where we sort of were landing here as a board last time.
So the rest of it's not going to pay attention.
Yeah, it's
started reading it.
It's just section C.
So what if it's a duplex or something, and it's not sold?
And it's typically at certificate of occupancy.
Right. I think there'd probably be, you know, there would be.
So that would be the problem.
Yeah. Single family res where.
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you're gonna build, and somebody's gonna buy. There's a transaction, initial transaction that would be at closing, but for rental, for duplex, townhouses, apartments,
it'd actually be at final inspection. I think just for the reason because that's the stop point that the county has because if final inspection happens.
Unless there's
I'm on
efficiency.
The county side. I think it's important. I think this is important. But of course, we want to be sure the county gets the money and the school gets the money. It's just how you get to the finish line.
Yeah. I'll be back. Thank
you, Martin. I'll be back.
Thanks, Martin. Thanks, Martin.
I'm just going down the hallway for a minute.
So is this, what do you want?
I think there's more. You put in the system. Yeah, I mean, I think. Obviously, we needed to bring this up because the county is facing a deadline. I think there's some policy issues that need to be talked about, maybe not policy, but just practical issues. You know, one is, does it should be defined? Should we have the 20 unit per builder limitation? One, two, what is the best time frame for various product types? Obviously, we're going to have to craft language. There's a practical aspect of it that those of us that do home building are familiar with.
So,
Do you want input? Or what are you looking for?
I think it's a work in progress.
Yeah. I think Marty's trying to seek out Evergreen's comments. It sounded like as well. This may not be the perfect time to be asking Evergreen, however, because they just kind of got shorted on the city of Vancouver side for school impact fees by accident. So just as a note, as a site.
I think the school districts are probably going to be the... depending on their reaction to it, you may have your answer as to whether or not the 20-unit limit has to be a reality. I think that would be not optimal for the county, because it adds one more thing to track. Oh, how many has he got so far, with the way the bill is written, and it, you're supposed to give substantial credence to what the school districts have to say, if they're all really against it, I'm not sure that the county would have it.
Be able to go above the 20-unit threshold.
I don't know that they'd be able to push it too much.
There's a, from my perspective, but I appreciate this, that you thought about this quite a bit. It's obviously, it's more efficient, I think, both for the home builders, the title companies, the county in this case, to create just one system. And I really don't think there's honestly too many builders that are building 20, maybe more different ways, but 20 units or more here in single family jurisdiction. That's quite a bit in a healthy market. So practically speaking, it doesn't seem like that limitation serves much.
Clarify what you just said, that 20, not many builders that are building 20 units?
Per jurisdiction?
Per year.
Relative to the number of builders.
There's 100, 2 or 3 or 6 units a year kind of thing.
We were talking about this issue about the office. So that's one aspect of it. I still recognize that the school districts have to come before each jurisdiction every so often to ask for impact fee changes. So there's got to be a good take there.
Good partnership.
That I hope
there's not. Should be. The reality
there's
is
a theory.
But if I'm the school district, I'm going to do open demand. Okay, how many houses are going to be built in Clark County in 2016? I don't know, 1,200 or something?
In unincorporated county or?
Unincorporated, which would be
1,200.
Plus whatever multifamily units you build, call it 1,500 to 2,000 units.
Maybe more than that.
Okay,
potentially going up.
I'm just trying to do the math real quick. 2,000 units times X per an average school impact fee is a total amount of some amount. I'm going to raise my hand and say, that's a lot of money. I don't want to defer. I think that's the expectation. I wouldn't. I'd say, and then the response is, well, state law says up to 20 per building. Okay, can't do anything about that. Mm-hmm. That's where it's going to land from the school district. Of course, I see it just the opposite. I think there's a greater benefit to the county.
To me, there's a benefit to the school district that they have more time to identify what they have incoming, income generation that's going to be coming in, then to spend that money. It gives them a larger window in how to allocate it if they know what's coming in. That's always been part of the issue. I think it would help them, but I
can't. Do they have a sunset on the spending money?
Yeah, 7 years on impact fees. Is that accurate? Is it 10?
So they get a little extra time now.
So they get extra time to identify. They know they can plan.
3 months.
Yeah.
Six months.
So maybe.
I agree, though. They're going to see
them. The benefit to the builder is a lot more significant. than the detriment to the school district, in my opinion. And ultimately, that means the homeowner, the buyer, there's a bigger benefit. If you don't have to capitalize and borrow all that money.
It's about the financing structure too. Because now, if you get a construction loan, you're having to pay these, you have to pay fees on it, you make interest payments on it, in fact, it's not there yet. So most of the time, this is written into a construction loan. So you don't have to include your impact fees. You basically close on it when the home closes, and it goes to the ultimate buyer, and it's not closing. That never has to be included. So that's where it helps. Suggestion. It sounds like this is kind of a work in progress. Do you need anything else from this group, or is this something that you take back and work with Marty on and at a future meeting? We have some actual language to maybe act on.
Yeah, I think I wanted to hear the discussion again so it helped inform Marty and I. How aggressively to push on the districts. It seems like sale of the lot and my own inspection is the best option.
So, Jamie, ultimately, this goes with the county councilors.
Correct.
I think it's affordability issue. That's one of our, I think that's a good idea.
Well, that's why it was passed.
Yeah. That may be your substantial weight. I mean, I'm concerned about that as well. I think you brought that up. Mm-hmm. Getting that hurdle.
Yeah.
That's a fairly high hurdle, but affordability might trump that. But that's substantial weight. It's legally a fairly high.
It's frustrating too. I mean, hurdle. Some of the impact fees for the districts are going up 300-some%. And this is stuff that local government struggles with this. I know we struggled with this at the City of Vancouver, the Affordable Housing Task Force, is how do you get affordable housing when fees are so high? It kind of creates a conundrum there. So this would be one way, I really think, that the school districts could be a little bit with the high fees.
It's a national problem, by the way. I sent you an article. Interesting. There was a national article, I can't remember, out of Forbes or someone. All the home builders nationally are saying they can't put affordable homes on the ground, in large part due to the cost of regulation. First time I've ever seen that type of article on a national level.
On the West Coast. Mm. Not just here, but along the West Coast is like the largest affordability crisis. One suggestion to the school districts about the 20 is pure logistics. Did they really want to have multiple systems where they have to account for it and they have to know if they have to collect more or less? There's too much potential for error. And it's just for them, they might want to have one system that they follow every time. And then it's simple and there's not a big chance of it getting missed. Or they can say, hey, they have the right at any time to shut it down after 20 from each other. And if they track it and they find that there's 20, they can shut it down so they know they can't defer anymore. It's an accounting nightmare.
Yeah.
And they might not want that nightmare either. They might not like that they have to defer fees, but they might like it less if they have to now account for 20 units for each building. They might not like that either. So.
On the financing side, so construction financing, do you see that this would create any issues with getting financing on how a lien would be recorded or with the banks?
No, I've been talking to enough title companies about this and some other tangential things related to that and some banks. They don't really see that as an issue. I think it's just going to become an education thing for our entire industry.
I heard Marty, right, specifically says it's subordinate to any first construction.
Yeah.
Then that answers it.
Yeah. So it's voluntary, right?
Yeah, you can still pay it, really. Or flush with cash.
Like Jeff is now.
like to be his up front.
That's very interesting.
It could be that you have to pay $50 in recording fees to get the deferral. And if you're doing it out of cash, it might not make sense. You just want to do it and not have to worry about releasing it and recording it. I can see that happening.
True. But it could be the difference between somebody being able to build a house and somebody not being able to build a house.
In that case, yes. Yep.
Should get Jeff the nickname, Jeff the F1.
So you got enough, Jamie?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all right.
So we'll table this for now and bring it back at some point.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Next, Susan Shoreland Extensions.
So, on your tables are two packages. One for residential and some of the more common exemptions that we do, and the other is for non-residential. I know you guys are all just seeing this for the first time, so I'll email it to you and just want to get any facts and specific comments. I would appreciate that, but the idea is that there's a much easier form on that, and it kind of, especially for residential homeowners who are trying to understand the process, it kind of walks them through. It's less required narrative and information from them. And then also on our side, a staff report that planners can do quickly, you know, checkoffs, and hopefully, especially with the residential staff, they won't even have to make very many changes at all. Just do the review and get it out is the idea.
Susan, can I ask a question, please?
Yeah.
So right now there is a shoreline exemption process.
Yes.
And this is an attempt to streamline that?
That's right.
Okay.
And I want to get I've sent it out to other folks as well. I want to get comments from you guys, get comments from other staff and interested parties, make the changes, and then I'd like to get it started as soon as possible.
And Brent, what did you just give us?
So this is the equivalent for the wetland habitat portion of our interview. So it attempts to do some of the same things as streamlining what some of what we currently have to write is findings for in the current form.
Thank you.
So it can't be quite as, I guess, prefabricated,
yeah,
because we have a lot of unique situations. Sure. But you know, in terms of characterizing what's on the site for the record, there's a lot of check boxes in this form that we want to complete, and document avoidance in particular.
Mm-hmm. Susan, just maybe as an example, it might be helpful, as a residential application comes in for a single family home on a single lot, mm-hmm, in shorelines, can you walk us through that? Two scenarios. One is scenario one, it's purely shorelines, and essentially that's the issue there. Second one has a wetland buffer on it, or habitat buffer.
And timing, or?
Just kind of what I'm trying to understand is that it's on the levels of review, what I'm really kind of getting to is how integrated is that review if there's an environmental issue besides a shoreline on the site? That's the question that I'm trying to understand.
I think they pretty much run concurrent.
They do. Or is it, so the shoreline exemption, would that cover the shoreline piece as well as the environmental other element piece, or
like wetlands and habitat?
Exactly.
We're still having different staff do both of the reviews, and the idea is at the end we're going to compile them into one. We're going to take the have and wetland comments and at least put the conditions together, but probably. Well, we haven't figured out exactly what we're going to do with that, but probably still have two reports. We have one list of conditions.
What I'm kind of getting to is, can the shoreline just be partialed off as an exemption? And then, because it kind of feels that way from these two applications, and then the wetlands riparian is kind of a separate thing, or is it integrated?
There's a statutory requirement in the shoreline area that they're integrated and everything, all of the critical areas that are in the shoreline management area are addressed as part of the shoreline review under shoreline master program. And so that's one of the things that we struggle with, because we look at this on a single site, we're looking at it as all the same thing, whether it's in the shoreline or out of the shoreline. And you know, technically, we have to write a recommendation to the shoreline administrator, and then we cross that shoreline management area line, and then we have to issue a permit. And the standards are slightly different because of the language that was adopted in the shoreline master program with regard to the performance standard, particularly the habitat. In outside of shoreline, the performance standard is substantially maintained function. Inside the shoreline, it's no net loss. And those sound the same, and they kind of are the same, but substantially maintained function prevents us from allowing much in the way of temporal loss of function. We actually have a little more flexibility in the shoreline because of the no net loss, the way that that's been interpreted in context primarily of wetlands over the years, that you know, we can consider longer term impacts and longer term mitigation strategies in the shoreline area. So we do have to treat those separately. But what I've attempted to do with our piece is to prepare one document that addresses both. And if there are conditions that apply to both, they're called out once. And then if there are specific conditions for each circumstance, that those are listed separately.
Not really so. I'm just thinking, maybe as an example, a lot of this is built out, but on the Salmon Creek Trail area, near that area, you have a house up on the hill. One house has a riparian buffer impact. The other house does not, and it's clearly outside of the riparian area. So that would be clearly a shoreline exemption without anything else involved with it. The other one would be an integrated process, which would then deal with the riparian issue for the no-net loss of functions and shorelines as an integration. I mean, just that's how I'm seeing those two.
If it's in shoreline, it's automatically riparian habitat.
Well, not what went all 200 feet.
Well, a tight test water has its
250 foot
riparian. So usually the scenario is we have riparian habitat that extends beyond the shoreline area, unless it's floodplain.
So in pretty much all cases, you're going to be, on the residential side, it's going to be.
Right. It's more common to have wetland issues outside of the shoreline that might be separate, or no wetland issues in a shoreline scenario.
But I like the idea of the streamlining branch of that. That's great in terms of like trying to deal with those issues. But I think the challenge has been trying to get a quantitative amount of information that the applicant needs to provide, especially on the shoreline side. You don't have to write a 30, 40 page narrative to describe essentially what you're trying to mitigate for, which is more on the riparian buffer and wetland elements that is quantified and kind of boiled down. I think that's the challenge. But it kind of gets back to what you were doing, Susan, I think, which is, I think, the issue about trying to identify what are those conditions. Are you removing some vegetation that it's not significant? Or, you know, is it restorative? You just sort of seed it over? Or you actually cut trees? It's just a much bigger deal, you know, so it is complicated. I mean, I get the integration piece. I think that's probably the biggest challenge. I think for single family, that's probably the biggest challenge.
So are you thinking this is getting at?
I think it's a lot better on the, that goal. I haven't jumped to the non-residential, which I have some comments on as well, but I wanted to kind of get the people, board members' thoughts on the residential side, like the issues they've had.
Yeah. I mean, this is certainly simpler. I've been involved with the shorelines from the single family residential side. This is certainly way simpler. Yeah. We're always going to have to deal with the environmental stuff, regardless. Yeah. And so that's, while Brent has made an attempt to simplify that, we're still going to have to do what we have to do. Our hands are tied as far as
that. But, and that it's never really been on his side. It's really been kind of on the shoreline side. I mean, but that kind of pulls it all together. That's, you know.
So,
So as far as that end is concerned, yeah, this is, I wish you got this.
I got some job. One, I echoed my said this is great. So if I'm the end, this is so much better than what we have now. I mean, a huge report. A few just general questions on what I read through. I was trying to run through like a scenario. Number four confused me a little bit. So, completely describe any proposed clear integrating, including in the project, includes such items as, you know, the monetary material. And then below it, it has two check boxes. No clearing within the shoreline area is proposed, no grading within the shoreline, no grading. So, clearing and grading. The one above, does this mean for the whole project or just for the project in the shoreline? Because they're different.
Yeah.
And they should be regulated differently. So, when they say, completely describe any clearing or grading, including in the project, do you even care about the whole project?
Included within
the shoreline. Do you care about within the shoreline?
I think we care about the shoreline.
So maybe that's a clarification, because I can see that being added, like, well, no, you're doing all this grading. It's like, well, no, it's in the shoreline. It doesn't differentiate that.
Well, if you have critical areas outside of shoreline that are being affected, it would be good to include those, because then we can use this document for that review as well. You don't have to care a separate document.
Then we have a separate, maybe a separate motion that talks about other grading activities
in the shoreline outside.
With outside of the shoreline.
Yeah. And well, I appreciate the simplicity. Also, comes to say, I think we almost need to add a few more questions. So, when you look at this, especially information on impacts to wetlands or habitat, kind of where you talk about the forest practice, I almost think you need to have a question about wetland fills. Are there any wetland fills proposed, or you know, that there's pieces that can affect a floodplain? Does it make film a floodplain? Things that could trigger something additional. So if a counterperson looks at this and says, do we need these additional information? What questions are they going to use to determine that? And having a question for each one of those may make it easier for staff to review it. So I'm thinking scenarios I'm thinking of, is there a fill in the floodplain? Does this need like a little more? So a better map revision, there's something associated with it. Is there a wetland fill? This is from another experience. If you have a wetland fill, there's some issues with potential exemptions. So if anything like that could affect it, it'd be good to have a question in there. And you're saying if you're working in a shoreline, you're working in habitat, so maybe you don't even need a question for habitat. But
no, it's you're automatically in there. The question before is there any other activities outside of the shoreline jurisdiction that covers that 50, that extra 50.
Yeah. Okay. So you could be in habitat though and not having any impact to the habitat. They're not cutting down a single tree. So you could be technically in the shoreline, but that shoreline area has no trees in it, no vegetation. Mm-hmm. It's lawn. So when you put a house in it, you're not clearing any critical habitat. It's already previously disturbed.
Yes. Well, it's still technically an impact, but it might not require an opinion.
That's, yeah.
Okay. And I guess, you know, that's one of the things, if we can identify those issues up front when somebody comes in and it's really that simple, we may waive the habitat review fees because we're not going to need to look at anything in detail. You know, unless the ordinary high water mark is critical because we provide that service. In terms of verifying or providing the ordinary high water mark. But it's critical to whether or not the criteria are met or set back is met, then we do need to charge the fees to do that.
And I think where you're going there is asking us some more of these questions. This is what's going to kick it into a non-exemption status.
Yep.
And they want to know that off front.
They do, yeah. Once you go through this and you think you're an exemption, you put it out.
Yeah.
You want to go up front?
I think it's going back to kind of what's being impacted, as you're mentioning as well, which is, you know, it's essentially lawn or a field without tree impacts, and that's what ends up being the result.
Or previously impacted
area. It's interesting though, because like the example for Salmon Creek is interesting. Whipple Creek could be a different scenario. Potentially, there are some creeks that may not have 200-foot buffer areas off of them. so you could be beyond those. And so, I mean, I just, as an example, I'm not trying to get you complicated here, but just, I mean, you could theoretically be all the way outside of the riparian and still be in shorelines as well. So that's another scenario. I don't know how often that comes up.
It's a possibility. Vancouver Lake is the only example that I can think of.
What's that?
Vancouver Lake. When you're outside of 200 feet of the ordinary high water mark, but you're still within the floodplain, that's your own jurisdiction. That's the only circumstance that.
Right, but the riparian area extends to that kind of perpetual floodplain.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. That's an asset, yeah, I think, that it's connected to the Columbia River. But
I remember that was an option, whether you go to the floodplain or not.
It is an option.
It's an option.
The county decided to do it for
example. Yeah.
Vancouver has portions that are the 200 feet, all of the waterfront, intensive waterfront is 200 feet.
Yeah. And all Vancouver regulates Vancouver Lake to the flood, the entire flood. So it's,
like, it's still covered.
Thousands of feet from the area.
So you have this, should we send this out electronically for you to look at? And if you have any edits you want to suggest? Keeping it simple
great.
Still.
I'd like to circulate around that. Yeah.
I think it's really, really good, Susan, and that, I think this is going a long ways towards, it's really complicated, the whole combination thing about the impacts. I think if we can get to the point of, like, simplicity, where you don't have to write a huge narrative along with it, I mean, I think that everybody gets if there's a repairing impact or a weapon impact, it's got to be mitigated before. I think we've always understood that. It's more the shoreline description part. I do have a couple comments on the non-residential side. And just a couple things, just to kind of look at, I think the biggest item, I think, is repair and maintenance. If you have an existing, let's say it's an existing, and I'm not sure how much the county really even has commercial in the way of docks, but if you have an existing commercial dock and you wanted to replace it, same footprint, you're going to go and you're going to change, you're just going to replace what's there. You're going to change the boards out, you're going to change the tiles. This happens all the time in Vancouver. It seems like that should be a relatively simple exercise to identify same footprint, same configuration, consistent with the program and definitions of what shorelines allow on for maintenance and repair. And that should be the extent of that description. That's how we're dealing with that in other jurisdictions.
So what do they use? What exemption do they use?
The
repair and maintenance?
Using repair and maintenance.
So if you marked repair and maintenance on this particular application, and then at the top of page 2, you describe how that meets the exemption, maybe you tease out what it is that you're doing.
And I think Ford gets to it as well, Marty. The same footprint. I think that the challenge is when you start to get over to 6, how much documentation you're going to need to provide in number 6.
Yeah.
This is not, in my belief, for repair and maintenance should be an extensive narrative that you have to go into for something you're replacing that's already been authorized. It's also exempt from SEPA as well. So there's a regulatory exemption for maintenance and repair under SEPA, which also emphasizes that consistency. So that probably is one of the bigger items. And it may not just be docks. It could be residential electrical pole next to
guardrails
for the county. It could be public works, yeah. I mean,
sewer line.
Water line.
No, we don't care. Keep going.
Honestly, public works is one of our biggest requesters of exemptions for non-residential exemptions. So,
and it's just, I think it's an order of magnitude. I think this is definitely hitting the same stride and definitely in the right direction. But I think that's the critical thing is on 6, and it's very, some jurisdictions, it's like, you know, you're writing a letter, like a 2-page letter. Other, you know, jurisdictions are asking for a lot more, or might ask for a lot more. And I think, you know, Marty pointed out Snohomish County, which is pretty simple. Bellevue is pretty simple. So if there are other examples in Washington where I don't think it needs to be, I think it kind of comes down to there you can prove that it was authorized to begin with and you're simply just replacing it. You're not cutting a bunch of trees down. You're just replacing the boards on a dock. And that would include pilings as well. And our company's done many of those, which are in other jurisdictions where they've been exempt.
So we can circulate both these around for review and edits. Yeah.
Yeah, they haven't had time to really.
They haven't. How quickly can these people come up to speed? I'm asked to come up to speed on all kinds of things in 2 minutes.
You can actually have more.
That's why you're.
I'm a 12. I'm a 12 speed or something.
You got
21 speed.
Yeah.
Very good work.
Yeah.
Good
what
work.
Question. The $6,416. Where's that come from? Just out of curiosity.
The WAC.
The WAC.
Is WAC, and did they? Where does it go up?
Yeah, it does. It's gone up.
It used to be 2,500.
It was 50 some hundred, and now it's 62.
So it does go up.
64, 60.
Yeah.
Some
kind of a.
Yep.
I'm sure there's some weird formula.
It's not. Yeah, it's not a bad number actually. I'm just kind of curious.
It actually comes up more frequently than you might think.
Yeah.
Are you having a teeper on a road and you're just slightly in the shoreline jurisdiction?
We build roads really cheap.
Yeah. So thank you. This is great.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I welcome all of your comments. So I'll email it out to all of you and then please send me back correct. So the second thing.
Go ahead, boundary line adjustments.
Is, I don't know, I think a lot of you probably have experienced this, but so the two agenda items are actually shoreline exemptions / BLAs. There's a minor change, so I didn't even bother asking Rosie to send the agenda. But BLAs was really with shoreline exemptions, and so that is an item in one of the residential forms, in the residential form. So I included that, and if you have any comments about BLAs in shorelines, make them with the residential form, if that makes any sense. Okay, so item 5 was really possible changes to what we're doing in land use, and one of the things that we're thinking about that I wanted to talk about today was coordinating FSR and EEG.
Was what?
Coordinating the FSR, final site plan review, with the final engineering. So, in the past, we've done this different ways, but for a while, I think it was from about 2010 to 2012, 2013, folks from Public Works were actually doing the final site plan reviews, and they were requiring final site plan to be submitted with the final engineering. And I think the process was a little bit more streamlined. I don't know exactly how, but in the past few years we've gotten away from that, and I think it's caused a lot of confusion both on our end and on consultants' end. Sometimes people think that with submitting the final engineering, they have submitted for final site plan, and it comes up late, and that's not a good thing. On our end, we're doing multiple reviews at different times to make sure that the ENG is matching with a future FSR. I also think the code actually totally supports this. It talks about final site plan and final engineering being submitted. So I included in your packet that section of code. But I wanted to get your guys' comments about what you think about requiring those. On our end, it would be a small change.
Requiring what?
Requiring the final site plan review application to come in at the same time as the ENG. We would ask that you make an appointment either with someone from engineering or with land use. And on our side, it's usually Angie Merrill or Shannon Lazzarini. On the engineering side, it's usually Melissa Tracy or Harriet Padmore or sometimes Diana Nutt. Mm-hmm. They would contact the other group. We would have one person from each group ready to take your FSR and your ENG in at the same time. So it really shouldn't be that big of a change. The main change is that we would be processing them at the same time, and making sure that they're going forward at the same time, because it's really gotten kind of confusing for them not going through the same process.
So a few things that led to it, and the way old staff reports are done, that can confuse things too, because there's these conditions saying that prior to final site plan approval, you need to have these covenants recorded and all that
stuff. We're going to get rid of
that. Okay.
That's going to be a non-issue.
Good. So that has to go with it.
Yes.
But the old decisions that say that can get confusing when someone is by the book and they're just reading the decision and say, the decision says this, you got to get a post-decision review to not submit a covenant that you can't even do until construction's done prior to final site plan, when the county changed final site plan to engineering. So I'm good with either one of them as long as it's consistent, because there has been problems with inconsistency.
Yep.
And then you get to doing the Mylars and then they start the final site plan or Mylars. That's, I think, what's come up, because there hasn't been a clear direction of how that the process is.
Susan, this is a question. Would the team planner or the team lead on, would they follow that through in that example that you're giving? I mean, I think that's part of the challenge. I mean, I've seen it both ways, and it's good and bad. I've seen both good and bad with both systems, and I think part of that in the old system was you'd have a planner that would review it, and something completely different after that that had no knowledge, really, of the project property at all. That was not a good scenario. I mean, it never had a good outcome. I think if that planner could follow it through, all the way through final site plan, that would be helpful.
Okay, so here's what we're thinking about, what we've been moving towards. We have, with FLD, we have one of our planning techs, moving the review forward, making sure that everybody's doing their review. So the planner is sent the plat and they're asked for planning comments. Engineering is commenting.
With the initial reviewer, preliminary.
Yes.
Happens at preliminary, but also happens at FLD. And there's one planning tech that's keeping track of that and moving it forward. We want to go to the same process with the FSR. So Angie or Shanna would be making sure that that's meeting timelines, making sure everybody's getting their reviews, everything's routed correctly. But the planner's still looking for planning comments and planning conditions. And the other groups are doing that as well. So. It's not having somebody else, another planner, do the review, but it is having someone else make sure that all the steps are followed, because that's the part that they're really good at, I think. But if you guys have comments.
Previously, when Richard was reviewing FSRs, I don't believe that there was any input from the original planner, unless an issue came up.
Well, and I've had the reverse where he did the front end of that and somebody else, and this is going back to
Right, and that's when the valve is when that was when the color works.
Possible.
But the planning tech would be continuous, it sounds like, through that that process, which I think would be really helpful.
And it's consistent with the process for the FLD.
Trying to make things like FLD and FSR run as much the same as they can, so yes, people are used to the process and understand what all the steps are. And the planning techs specifically are good at, if they don't have a comment back from the planner, and the planner's doing other things, they go and bug them and make sure they get it, and they keep things on track, potentially better than some of the planners. So I want to have them in charge.
I think some of the urban heavy design and architecture projects, they may not be a disadvantage to separating those processes out to final site plan and final engineering, because some of that information on design may not be up to speed with the engineering, and those may not be that frequent, but we've had some situations where it was actually an advantage where we could submit civil first, and then these were heavy design projects, and that's just a thought. I'm not sure where that line is. If it's a jack in the box, probably not that big of a deal.
But what kind of design elements are you talking about?
I'm talking
building design or
site
design.
Say you're dealing with an architecture building that's like four stories. There's urban development that's going to happen in the county. I mean, the architecture are like elevation plans,
sure,
facade issues, those kinds of things. I mean, it's those pieces, landscaping, and let's say there are special screening requirements for that. They may not come up that frequently,
yeah.
But as the county urbanizes more, you're going to see more of like what Vancouver has, and that would be one comment.
So are you specifically talking about Highway 99 and mixed use, or even bigger?
Well,
that's the only time you have.
That may not be like, yeah, and I was actually, thinking of a project in the Gorge, which we just were doing that. But, I mean, that may not come up off that frequently, but that was advantageous to be able to separate those out.
Okay.
But I think the same thematic element may not be on Highway 99. Maybe that's the only place that it would be. But if there were urbanized development, multi-story architectural components.
There might be areas in the county where you'd see that.
And
we would take those, maybe look at those under exception. And the only kinds of design elements I'd be thinking about would be like building design and maybe some landscaping, but it would be exceptional.
Yeah, and I think with that caveat, that's the only the only part there. That's probably not the majority. That's probably
right.
More of a city of Vancouver issue, perhaps.
We've done this two or three different ways. When it was under Public Works, we would fill out a final site plan application form that was kind of a master form. For Public Works, now we have a separate planning form for final site plan submission, but yet it is still on the master form for Public Works also. By the way, will we have just one application form that we will need to fill out for the engineering and final site plan submission? Please say yes.
No leading witness.
Yeah.
How about I'll work on that?
Yeah, well, consider it. And the reason why is that, and this is totally an internal thing in our office, we have an engineering tech that takes care of all of our engineering systems. Us planners take care of all of the planning systems. Now we have to have those two dovetail somehow. And while we have great communication in our office 99% of the time, that 1% occasionally happens to where we,
generates 99% of the anxiety.
Right.
And kind of with Mike and Eric's comment, to make it, that would be beneficial, to make it as transparent as possible. I mean, because right now it is a little confusing, to be quite honest, about these are final site plan conditions of approval. Are they also engineering conditions of approval, or are they not? And that is not really clear sometimes.
I think that that's going to be more a function of when those conditions are conditioned. And I think that will be clearer as we move into moving away from some of the ways that the county has been, when the timing of some of these conditions. And I think that'll make it a little clearer. It's pretty clear right now which are civil conditions and which are planning conditions. We've never really had an issue with confusion there. It's more, why do we have to have this done now at this point in time when it really should be later on down the road? And there is a number of reasons why that should be.
So one of the big points of emphasis for our new system implementation is when we go to our third phase, which is going through land development entitlement, we're going to spend a lot of time on how we treat conditions. And in my mind, a lot of conditions are not conditions, as they're more development standards or requirements. There's no like cause and effect, or when X happens, Y is required. So conditions are going to be treated differently in the new system. And Susan and one of the business analysts from our vendor who's got a planning background will work on that.
Okay.
So hopefully a new system will tease that out more transparently, more clearly
as well. I might
suggest
at least touching base with Diana on that, because I forwarded her what the city Vancouver does with regards to their conditions, how they track them, and how they make sure that nothing falls through the cracks, and when those conditions are required, and things of that nature. More information.
I think it's great that you guys are looking at this issue. I think that's I agree with Mike. I think that it's a lot clearer than it used to be historically. But I think it's still, there's still some room.
Yeah. And with everything like this, the shoreline stuff, the EMG, FSR, you know, if you think of stuff later, email me, let me know.
Sure.
If you try it and it doesn't work, let me know. If you try it, it's awesome, let me know.
Yeah.
No, more. Yeah, right.
Thank you.
Sure.
So we are on to public.
So just real quick, you know, earlier this year I wanted Susan to concentrate her time and energy on managing land use review. She was working half-time in admin and half-time in land use review, so I was able to make a change, and I think that this work is reflective of her being able to spend time more on this stuff and take her for her, you know, give her some feedback, good, bad, and indifferent. So I'm happy that she's back in land use 100% of the time. I don't know if there was any, I doubt there was any mention of this, but with Mark McCauley's decision to reorganize the county effective January or July 1st, Brent is an environmental permitting staff on the private side stuff will be coming back into community development. So Brent and I met a couple different times. I think there's going to be some opportunities for Brent to liaison to other, I'd like a nice tight liaison from out of this department and public works and even within my own department in building and land use review. So we're going to be working together on Brent's, you know, here and now and in the future.
Brent, are you going to be heading that division? Or do you know? Yeah.
I mean, with Lance and Keith, they'll be working for Brent.
Yeah. But then under?
Under, yeah. So as it stands, Brent will be a environmental permitting, mm-hmm. and it'll be a direct report to me. We have this transition time between now and July 1st to kind of firm up some things. There were a couple other people who were, you know, are they coming into community development? Are they going to public works? Or one group, solid waste, might be going into public health. It's a very good chance that they will be going to public health. So for the time being, you know, and then we've met twice, and I need to schedule regular meetings with Brent on just keeping ties to us. I don't know if you want to add anything, Brent.
I see it as an opportunity to improve how the work that we do integrates the building, with engineering, absolutely.
Yeah.
And definitely it's going to, you know, putting us back in the loop of land use is going to help quite a bit.
We had to work on things like space planning and budget and all that other stuff.
I'm sure you did.
That's a good
a lot of details.
Yeah, it's a good mention, Marty. So just to dovetail on that, so right now it's anticipated clean water will come into public works and vegetation management I think also coming into public works. So.
Great. Thank you guys for the update. I think we're on to, unless there's anything else, we're on to public comments.
Mike, Mr. Chair, just before, we still have to set an agenda for, so can okay. you do that after public comment then?
Do you have items that you'd like to speak on?
I've got the worksheet. We don't have anything on our agenda. Yeah. I've got the
July's wide open.
So that, yeah. I think that's something we need to talk about.
Yeah.
When we have this PUD proposal that Steve's having a talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I think that might
maybe
be one
we
of,
can,
yeah.
Let's have them talk, and then maybe
that might be high. That was kind of where.
Okay.
I think that would be a nice segue.
Okay.
So public comments, yes, okay. Steve.
I spoke on this I think two meetings ago. I'm sorry for the late handing out. I was trying to get cranked out before this meeting. I'm even noticing some typos in the email, so. This refers back to the 72nd Street project that Avo's developing, and originally started out as a 232-lot single-family detached project. And I think I tried to make this as brief as possible. I think if you go through the procedural history, there will be several issues jump out. There's clearly some inconsistency in the way staff interprets the PUD code. That part's pretty clear in here. There's probably, it's pretty clear that the county itself is really clear on what it wants to do, what it needs to do. And so basically, to cut to the chase in the analysis section, and Don, I sent Don by email a whole bunch of supporting documentation for all this too. So, staff report of the hearings examiner decisions to clarify some of these comments in this group. But I think if you drop down to the middle of the analysis paragraph on the second page where we address the key questions, and it's the questions we have now having come through this process are, and to get to where we are right now, we are in post-decision review. After roughly a year or so of this process, the only real distinction between the original design concept and the final concept on post-decision review is we're stuffing 12 townhouses in the middle of a 250 give or take lot development, which is sort of an absurd concession to the process. It's not really, they're not really something we wanted to build. They're not really an appropriate product for that area of the county right now. Place it kind of on a proposed park area, so it'll be a little more attractive that way. But anyway, so you know, we get down to the two key questions of, you know, what is the level of design flexibility we're trying to achieve in the PUD ordinance, and what changes may be necessary. And one of the things that jumped out in our particular situation is not only do we have medium density and high density zones next to each other, but they were also different comprehensive plan designations. And so to, you know, normally a rezone would have fixed this pretty readily because there are any kind of a number of rezone zoning options that would have worked for us. It's just we would have had to go through a comp plan amendment process as well, and that just wasn't realistic in any time frame we could envision. And so it seemed like the PD process was appropriate for this. So I guess that's what we're throwing back to the county is the scenario where you've got multiple comprehensive plan designations as well as multiple residential zones. Where does the county work fit in this?
Real quick, yes. A suggestion, and it's the problem that single family detached is not allowed in the R30, right?
Correct.
However, because it's the same comprehensive plan designation, you could do an administrative rezone to R22, which is only one over, right, that allows single family detached, and you might be able to put those back in. And you might be able to process, I don't think you can process that with the
rezone?
An administrative rezone, because it doesn't need any comp plans.
It's the hearing examiner though, right?
Rezone's
good. Rezone's good, hearing examiner, it's not administrative.
Yeah, now, it could have happened on
administrative.
It's not, well,
it doesn't go to the board.
It doesn't go to the board.
Yes.
It's a type 2 or type
3. Type 3.
Yes. Type 3.
Yes.
But that might get you where you want to go. It kind of has to go back to the
public hearing.
But it would be a type 3 post-decision review instead. And you might get there.
Yeah.
For this one.
A rezone on just the R30.
Yes. To R22.
Would all be.
Then you can do your original proposal.
I don't know how your blended densities would work out. You might have slightly fewer units.
We don't want more units. We're forced to put more units.
Gotcha. As a result of the blend of the two.
You're right.
Okay.
And so that may be right. And that's why I was trying to not make this project specific, because I've got to rely. We're using AKS Engineering. I've got to rely on those guys that they don't perform. Best route is from an engineering perspective on this, but clearly this process, the process we got into through the PUD ordinance didn't work, and it looks like it's just based on the interactions and staff, it's clear that there's our PUD code does not meet what it's probably intended for. So that's why I'm bringing it here. Because I think this case points out some of those.
So just real quick for the group, I believe the board will be looking at housing issues. And to the extent that you get a slate of issues on housing, you know, bogs down, whether or not there's a task force or a separate advisory committee or who knows what. But, you know, one of the things that has come up has been the PUD code to the board. They're also looking at ADUs in the rural area. They're looking at tiny homes. So there are a few housing issues that the board will be looking at, more than likely after the plan update is concluded. How they scope that and what they do with any kind of outreach, I have no idea. Somebody in the planning staff, I forget, Gordy told me who it was, the gal, the newer gal.
Sharon,
yeah, I think she's putting together a list of issues related to housing. So, you know, that's just food for the group to know about.
Clarification. So, Steve, you're bringing, you've had an issue that you think is of general interest.
Yes.
You're past your particular issues. So this is now of general interest, right? As Marty had just described, and we'll add it to the mix.
And that's why I phrased it when I said the key questions here are what level of design flexibility is currently allowed within the PUD across multiple and possibly conflicting zones. I left out zones and comprehensive plan designation. And two, what changes to the PUD code are necessary, if any, to achieve both flexibility in design and certainty in the approval process. Same arguments we always make.
And one of the other pieces I think that has come up in this group, and I'm not sure about, I think it has come at the board because we've had projects that were approved long ago, and then the board repealed the infill development code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So infill development as an option is something that will likely generate some discussion. So,
well, and the flexibility of the PUD ordinance changed significantly when the block
and our code
been changed significantly. So,
and Terry, in one of the adjunct pieces that I sent out, Terry Brooks commented, and on our motion for reconsideration, she pointed that out.
Yeah.
Very clear. It wasn't particularly helpful in the process, but she pointed it out very, very articulately. So
Marty, with the board of county councilors looking to do this, is there a time frame, or would it be?
They're not. Yeah. They're after June 30.
Okay, after June
30. To even consider what issues that they put on a plate for consideration. And, you know, as we all know, the more issues you put on the plate, the longer it's going to take. You know, to what extent does the board put together a task force, some other kind of you know, advisory committee? We've had like, I know there was an infill development task force. There was
that fell flat because nobody could agree or something like that.
I don't remember. It was, you know, a long time ago.
We had a presence on there. And
there were some.
The infill development ordinance went through pretty. I mean, there were a lot of neighborhood concerns, if I recall.
Yes.
But it went through fairly smoothly. It was a very good thing. And then when it hit the ground, it just didn't work.
Right.
And for whatever reason, it got taken off the table.
Well.
And I don't know what that reason was, because to me it seemed like tweaks and things like that.
When the mic is turned off, I'll explain some things.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, it wasn't until it got on the ground.
Yeah.
One other comment I want to make is, you know, it's sort of more project specific than this. If you actually do read the staff report. And I'll be kind about this, but it is an internal problem when two staff members are effectively having a policy argument in the context of the staff report. And that exactly happened here.
Yeah.
And that makes it very difficult to go in front of a hearings examiner and say, yeah, I've got a recommendation for approval here. Only it's not really a recommendation for approval. And that to me is an internal matter that really hurt this project. And that's just a policy I'd like to see implemented internally, that there's consistency of opinion within staff.
I feel like I have to say at least something. sometimes people make mistakes and give out the wrong information. That's always going to happen. And sometimes we get legal advice of what we're supposed to say. And I think both of those things happened with this example. I agree. We don't want this to happen. This kind of stuff makes us look bad. We don't like that. One of the things that I want to do as much as I possibly can is help with consistency.
Sure.
It's been an issue, and all we can do is work on it. But, we certainly didn't want this to happen.
I wouldn't be a good advocate for my client if I wasn't pointing that out. That's why I said I want to be kind of really was the killer on this
point. Yeah.
And I hope you feel that we've really tried to help with the post-decision review and making that work.
Nobody in my office has any problem. We just don't want it to happen. We got here.
You can blame me because I'm the boss, and I had the planning staff and the league and the attorney in my office. And I said that we need to do something about that. So no,
we're on track. Tony Combs.
We're
probably 400 next year. So we need to visit.
So yeah, we don't want to repeat those kinds of issues.
So, just kind of as a final thought, I mean, two questions. One, is it premature to put something on for discussion for PUDs without the board putting that together as an item for
any other housing?
Or, well, it so
ADUs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you think?
If you're interested in a couple of these issues and then you had a discussion and kind of had a tick list of things that you would want to share with the board, right?
Yeah.
That would be appropriate. But to get too far out in front and make a whole set of sweeping, policy changes or, start drafting an ordinance, that's getting out in front of the board too far. But in terms of, we know that you're interested in the PUD code and maybe accessory dwelling units in their rural area, not in the urban area, but in the rural area, and a couple of these other things. Here are some of the things that we'd like, if you were asking us, here are some things that we would add. And then if they get into we're going to put together a housing task force, if you will, and I don't know, I that kind of.
Before we do anything in particular on these issues, my recommendation would be to the board, are you interested in input on this? Are these things of immediate concern that you plan to address this coming year? In my opinion,
there's a timing issue.
Yeah, right. It's got to be relevant. Yeah. Are these relevant topics for you?
And timely.
So that probably is something you've gone through sidewalk with.
I can coordinate with Greg on as a vehicle. I mean, obviously, when we went through and did the annual report, it seemed like there was some acknowledgement. They didn't verbally come out and say, this is what we're going to, but there was not disagreement either.
There's a difference, right?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think they need to say clearly where do they want to go. But offline, I can talk to Greg about that issue. Besides that item, going back to Mike's point about being wide open next month,
I'm looking
for suggestions.
I'm just taking a look at what we've done. I'm still on the hook to get James some information on the super thresholds and injunctions, getting that kind of taken care of.
And I should mention that I have been exchanging calls with the college on that. So
Mike, do we want to place that on the agenda yet
for
update?
It's premature. I need to get Jamie examples.
Okay.
Let him know what the situation is so that he can provide some on-the-ground examples of how this has been interpreted up to a college so that they might have some more information. I hope your current conversations with them are going well.
very helpful, which is pretty difficult. Last thing is pretty
difficult. Who's that?
I think it's Annie.
Spit, yeah.
Chris is about a lot of blue.
Did you get that story?
No.
We've already talked about, we're talking currently about impact fee deferrals. We're talking about shoreline exemptions. I'm really just ticking these off. Plat alteration process, that's also something else that is on our list, but is more in Marty's camp. We've already discussed and reiterated our position on the infrastructure percent deduction for residential development. I think that Marty wanted to wait until after time mark replacement before we looked at really quantifying a. I want to kind of get away from the 60-day review process into a combined
concurrent review
process. Driveway locations on corner lots, that's ongoing. Retaining walls at the perimeter of developments, that's ongoing. Technology, that's more of an encouragement, which has already been done. Greg, you and I have had some offline conversations about reviewing concurrent review of engineering, final engineering plans and post-decision reviews. So we might want to come back and see what, if anything, has been taking place with that. Eric left, but he was going to kind of head up the grading permit improvements, process improvements. So now we get into accessory dwelling units in the rural zones. Archaeological review process timelines, again, that's kind of in Marty's camp, and I don't know if there's a whole lot we can do about that. In fact, there's probably nothing we can do about that, but it's something that's out there and has the potential to all the projects. Extending site plan and plat approval to Jamie. I mean, so everything that's on our list, we're currently doing.
I've got one suggestion, and this is kind of going back to the transportation side of things on a county. I think it'd be good to kind of get a refresh on the financial part, the impact fee discussions that we've been dealing with road and paying for infrastructure and where things are going. That would be a pertinent topic.
That would be more than an update from?
Well, it's kind of part of the comp plan. I mean, it's that might be a good topic. It kind of feels like from the point where we started, maybe a year and a half ago, there wasn't much concern about keeping up.
Right.
So currently, there's a big concern. I mean, that's my perception.
Okay.
So, is that TIF update? Are we talking TIF update through Matt Herman?
Because I know that we got the waiver.
There's that blends into this, but it's more about. I think it's just there's been articles in the Columbian about paying for roads, and they're recent. I mean, this is current stuff. So,
I think it would be helpful to get an update as to where the road fund stands.
I think
that's probably going to be the most illustrative.
It kind of comes back to this matching piece as well, which I don't completely understand about the funds they've got and how they match. I mean, what is that package?
Well, so the way I've always understood roads is you have the road fund and you have buckets of money that are coming, but you can allocate them here or there. Obviously, TIFs are an important aspect of that. It's supposed to be development, first place. Then you have the whole aspect of the private developer doing it, getting back the credits. Where it comes down to it, though, is if the county doesn't have an adequate road fund, it's harder for them to go out and leverage those dollars that they don't have to get other kinds of either loans. Public Works Trust Fund doesn't exist right now, but that is more grants or some other matching resources out there. And I know it's definitely one of the challenges we're facing on the 179th.
That would be dead on.
So road fund update, we're probably looking at Susan Wilson, who's the program manager there, and kind of give us a status update, take questions, just open discussion. And
I'm all for that, but what do we want to take away from that, Don?
I'm just suggesting a topical area where it's information. I mean, it's like the comp plan updates in some ways. I mean, really, we're not necessarily taking a position. We're just trying to stay in front of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be that we take a position, and,
we find out what's going on.
Well, exactly. That's the problem. I mean, it just feels like it's kind of in flux. It doesn't feel real. Yeah.
But is that something that we would weigh in on? That's more of a policy decision from the county council.
It might be. I mean, you know, it's. I think. I mean, isn't that much different though than the fee waiver? You know, is that different from, you know?
And I would argue we have limited input with the fee waiver.
We might. Yeah.
That's a policy decision. As I see it, I'm all for information. Want to know what the purpose out of that.
I was just looking for an update. I wasn't necessarily.
Well, maybe the update helps inform our various constituents that
Well, there is a tie when you're talking about major transportation improvements to allow urban holding to be lifted. That opens up property for development that otherwise would not be available.
That's good news.
Good question. That on.
Yeah. Or the other thing where I see it impacting stuff recently, as I know this is timely to the comp plan, is that we have all these circulation plans that have been adopted in the former urban holding areas and current urban holding areas, and because we have certain programs in place and certain impact fee stuff in place to suppress capital facilities costs. A lot of those roads are sort of falling off priority lines. It does impact development on a ground situation. Developers are very doing a full improvement. Okay. I'm trying to figure it out in county.
So are you telling developers for Atlas?
Partly to do with Arterial Atlas and how that interplays with the CFP and real world
development. Let's do that. So we can add that on. I'm not sure if that will cover everything. We'll talk, Greg, about the other pieces the board might want to consider. I mean, if they are if they're game on PUD, we could bring that back as a discussion point. Other topics.
That was the list, man. I'm telling you.
I'm thinking.
We're kicking butt this game.
Two meetings ago, we talked about, I think, Greg, we were asking you, and it kind of dovetails into what you were talking about, but it didn't have to do with just posters for the view, I don't think, but we're talking about the ability to reinstitute paying overtime or doing something to be able to run engineering plans either concurrently or very quickly after hearing approval and all so that you can cut down on the.
And I know the one comment on that came from Marty, and it was, I think they have the opportunity for overtime. But it's like kind of like us, so do we, but.
Yeah, it's not mandatory. It's optional, right? That was the feedback.
And people may not want to work overtime.
No, exactly. I remember someone said, and
yeah, I think Marty, that was Marty. It's
you
like
can't force it, which is great. It stuck in my head. I heard it from different engineers and proponents and whatever that, you know, that, but do we know, have we talked, have we offered, or I'm not sure where that stands.
I appreciate that Matt Clarkson, I ran into him down there outside yesterday, and he also suggested, what they do.
I talked to Matt in the permit center for quite a while, actually.
Was that yesterday?
Yeah.
Well, there's right now you just don't do it, right?
I mean, I think there are some things that are bottlenecking,
right?
And we can look at ways to turn some things around, maybe even to farm things out, right?
I mean, we're doing that.
Fully engineered stormwater plans on tax lots. Do we farm those out to a third party? And then the question becomes, is that third party also swamped where you can't get like a business week turnaround? So everybody's busy. And to the extent that we have outside firms to help us, they're busy.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, everyone wants to make hay while the sun shines.
Absolutely.
And we all know what happens when it storms. Because we're all involved in that. So,
you know. That's just a matter of trying to keep pace with the workload and the staffing that you have, or access to third-party review, so it's, I mean, there's just a, it's a, something that I am talking to folks about weekly.
It's interesting, I mean, from a development standpoint, what I'm hearing, and I feel it personally, is that, you know, I'd be more than happy to pay time and a half,
sure,
double, whatever, go to outside, anything, put it on the ground today versus next year, because
yeah,
everything that happened to us, it's very difficult with the PTSD that we all have to say a year from now I'm going to be okay. I mean, it's just, you know, so they, it, and that's how yeah, critical these things come, because you're, you know, you get a hearing in June and then you want to get engineering plans and you want to get started before winter, and yeah, you know, you're so close, but you're not
we
there.
We can look at ways
so
to,
yeah.
To what?
To thought.
To make things, you know, I mean, if a
certain timelines.
If I've got some large scale medical and it otherwise is a 6 week turnaround for structural review because we've got third parties that are really busy,
right,
what can I do to incent maybe a 3 to 4 week turnaround?
Yeah.
Can I get somebody a heads up earlier on that, hey, something's going to be submitted by, you know, the end of this month?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, kind of build some bandwidth within your firm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there we can have these discussions with people. My staff, you know, when it comes to, we get a crush of single family res, and I mean, we have so many plans examiners, and Jim has done some things to like, okay, we're gonna pick some plan reviewers and we're gonna just put them somewhere and, you know, pencils down,
yeah,
going away. I mean, there have been some opportunities that way.
Mm-hmm.
But at a point in time, it's like, well, everybody's working full capacity, maybe plus, and then, hey, who wants to do overtime Saturday morning?
Yeah.
Like, well, I haven't seen my family this week, so yeah, I thank you, but I'm going to pass this weekend.
It's a trick, and it's tough. And I think that from a development standpoint, the development community, at least the people I talk to, and you know, willing to take the risk in the sense that we know that
yeah,
if we're denied a hearing or whatever, that we've taken the risk. We pay whatever it is that we pay. But
I think the way to me, it's about affordable housing. If we can respond to the market demand in a faster time frame and provide more housing, there's a personal side that we feel, the development side, but we can meet the demand faster. We reduce the spikes, create more consistency. That's the ideal. That's what we shoot for. I know Marty, what I remember Marty commenting before about post-decision review running concurrently with final engineering was, it depends on
mm-hmm,
how much, what, that post-decision review, what are you doing? How much change does that create?
Yeah.
Does it make sense
right,
for us to take the next steps?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's just an arbitrary decision or if there's, you know, lines that
there's
can be
drawn in
the sand.
Yeah. There's some criteria.
That to me is worthwhile and would be very helpful. And then two, it helps us to then how much change we're going to go up. You know, it's like everything else, right? We go up to that line, but we're not going to go over it because we know time frame wise it's going to affect us and we can plan accordingly. So it, all those things coincide.
I know that it came up two meetings ago, Bill North, that warrants discussion. It sounds like it's on your radar. So,
well, I mean, we're hiring more people.
Yeah.
We're hiring a couple plans examiners, a couple more inspectors. We finally are going to have a building, an engineer for structural review in house rather than farm it out.
Nice.
We're sending all our SFRs out
on for your stormwater
yep,
plans.
Yep.
On tax lots.
Yeah.
So there are things we're doing, adding more staff and then getting them on board and productive 100%, that takes a little bit of time. I think the engineer that we have out, I mean, it's out on the street right now. I mean, we're advertising for it. So.
You said that you're farming out what?
The SFRs for the stormwater.
Single family.
Yeah, to turn those around. I think we're usually getting those turned around in about a week's time.
On tax lots.
Non-platted lots.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
On rural lots.
Tax lots, yeah.
I mean, anything anything else, yeah. I think. I mean, you got, it sounds like it's on your radar, anything,
yeah.
Anything else?
I think we've added more appointment time availability in the permit center.
Yeah.
That helps. So, yeah.
Don, I'm just a thought here. So it looks like we've got a little bit more room on the agenda. Maybe next meeting we just take more time, put it as an agenda item rather than public comment, and try to really look out the next 6 months, the second half of the year, kind of reset a 2.0, on items that we really want to look at. So
probably adding to that list, which it sounds like we burned through like 60% of it or whatever that is.
We're talking about.
Or maybe it's gone. Maybe it happens again.
Well, no, there's still ongoing that we still comment on. It's not quite there yet. It's just when that time comes, we add in. But like the information on the impact fee delays, that's going to come back to us. And there might be a fall biannual. Are you thinking about that at all?
No, not yet.
I like that idea.
We're not even done with the springs yet, right?
Is it appropriate to ask Mark as far as maybe for any sense or direction on where in particular items that are on our list?
Feedback.
Yeah.
I mean, and we kind of alluded
to have him here.
Yeah. I could certainly add that, yeah.
Yeah.
Here? Why don't we what?
Why don't we
ask him? You go to you, between you two, we go to
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll go to Mark.
We're just
on that.
Adding Mark into the equation.
Yeah.
We already tasked to do that.
So you're doing John,
you better adjourn or lose. Okay.
We got the Mark meter going.
We are adjourned.